My name is Jim Soderberg, and the date is August 4th, 2014. I'm at the home of Glenn Thorson in Mayville, North Dakota. And let's see, it says, where were you born? And
I was born in Mayville, North Dakota, 1941. Attended school, high school. I graduated in 1959 and attended Concordia College. And after 3 years of a Concordia, I had enough credits at that time, what they were doing, and I applied to medical school. And I also applied to a veterinary medicine school because my dad was a veterinarian. And I was accepted at both. And when I came home one day in the spring, I said, Dad, I got letters from both. What do you think? He said, you don't have to think. Do you want to take care of patients in an air-conditioned clinic or deliver babies in a hospital or deliver a calf and it's 10 below in the barn? I said, thanks. So I was accepted at UND Med School. It's 1962, finished 64, and then it was a two-year school at that time. And now, of course, it's four-year. But I transferred to University of Kansas and graduated MD 1966.
And who were your parents and what did they do?
My mother and dad were born on farms by Buxton, North Dakota at the turn of the century. My dad was born in 1897, mom was 1901, and they met in high school and whatever, and my father was the earliest trained Ohio State graduate veteran, Ohio State veterinarian graduate in Trail County. My mother graduated from a two-year program at Mayville Normal then, Mayville before at Mayville State, and she taught 2 years up north someplace and then started having family, married and had family. And so they are from Trail County. They grew up here, lived in Mayville. I was born here and grew up and went from there.
And how many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have one sister. I have two older brothers, and I am the baby of the bunch. My oldest brother died, and the second brother is still living and lives in Florida. And my sister is older than I, and she also is a retired nurse and lives in the Twin Cities. So we have three of us, my older brother in Florida, my sister in St. Paul, and me in Mayville.
Mm-hmm. And were you drafted, or did you enlist in the service?
I was at the right time of my training where the Vietnam War, and I just got the VFW magazine. The Gulf of Tonkin incident happened 50 years ago today. August 4th, I know that because I just read it last night. I still got memory for that. Gulf of Tonkin, when President Lyndon Johnson got the information that they didn't know what they were doing. And not because I don't like President Johnson, but because they got misinformation. And that was the beginning of the Vietnam conflict, August 4th, 1964. Well, I was in medical school, and of course I was exempt until I graduated. I knew that when I graduated, I would be vulnerable for the draft. Because of it, when I was at University of Kansas my senior year, I signed up for the Air Force Early Commission Program, meaning that when I did graduate and finish my internship, which I did in Fargo at St. Luke's, that as soon as I was done with my internship, I was committed to the Air Force. I did not want to go in the Army or Navy or Marines or whatever. I wanted to be a flight surgeon. I wanted to be a physician, go into flight surgeon, aeromedical training, and I wanted to fly. And luck would have it. I was, not luck, I guess, but I was accepted into the Air Force 5 days after I finished at Fargo my internship. My family and I drove to San Antonio and was sworn in as a young greenhorn captain. Mm-hmm. And was assigned to Aeromedical Space School in San Antonio at Brooks Air Force Base.
What were the dates of you were in the service?
It was the first week of July of 67, and I was discharged when I got home from Vietnam at the end of July of 69. So I had two active duty years, 5 years reserve, which at that point there was no reserve. I mean, there was a reserve on paper, but nothing else but I had to do. So I was active duty. After being assigned to flight surgeon training, I was assigned to Lubbock at Reese Air Force Base, where, again, fortunately, as a trained flight surgeon, people say, well, what's a flight surgeon? You don't do surgery in the air, and you don't fly. Well, I did fly, but you don't do surgery. Flight surgeon is a World War II, pre-World War II term, which docs go in, and some do surgery, some take care of shrapnel, and some take care of pilots and the crews, all their medical problems. And because of that, they let the flight surgeons, if they wanted to, they never had a gun at the head to fly or else, but wanted to fly with missions, they did. I wanted to fly. My best friend, picture of that gentleman right there on the fridge, Lieutenant Colonel, grew up with me in Mayville. His name is now retired Colonel, full Colonel Ballstead, Richard Ballstead. He finished Mayville State and wanted to fly. He became a career officer and a career pilot. I wanted to fly like Rich, except with glasses. I wasn't going to be a pilot. I was going to be a co-pilot. And that's what happened. I did get through the flight surgeon training, assigned to an air training command where we got to fly in T-37s, T-38s. The white bird over there is a T-38. That's a sports car of the Air Force. They still fly it. NASA still flies them for their pilots. And a year later, I got a Christmas card from President Johnson inviting me to Vietnam, June 1st, 1968, for 1 year to June 1st, 1969. And I served at Cameron Bay Air Force Base and was assigned again, luckily, to F-4 Fighter Squadron, the 559th Tech Fighter Squadron, the Billy Goats, hence the Billy Goat on my plaque. And they asked me when I got there, if you know, you don't have to fly, Doc. I said, I know I don't have to. And although my wife was a little bit hesitant about, why do you want to do that? Why do you want to go up and be exposed? Well, young and foolish, I guess. My friend, dear friend, was a pilot, and I wanted experience. Not full-time like he did, but occasionally. And I was accepted into the squadron very well because, yes, I will fly. And they needed pilots at that time. They were short of trained pilots.
How long was the pilot training?
Well, the pilot training, my introduction to flying was at Reese Air Force Base, and that was about 10 months. And that's when I got called up to Vietnam. And when I got there, of course, I'd never flown in an F-4, even though I had flown in other jets. This is a whole new ballgame because it's a fighter. It's a combat fighter. And when I got there, they inquired, are you interested in flying, Doc? Do you want to be a backseater? You're not going to fly the airplane, except you're going to, once you're in the air, you'll if you have a knack for it, we'll let you fly it, but you don't take off. Well, I had no business taking off and landing. First of all, you can't see from the back seat very well. Second of all, my job is not to take off and land. That was the front seater, the aircraft commander. And my roommate, picture on the right up there with my roommate and I, we still communicate monthly. We see each other in the winter in Arizona. And he and his friends put me in the back seat of that F-4 and took me out of the clinic, mercifully, and put me in the back seat on a trainer right there and said, all right, Doc, this is what you do to get the airplane going. And they rammed it to me for about 3 or 4 weeks. And I was apparently a quick study because they said, all right, you're ready for a check ride. And what a ride. And they took me up and they monitored to see if I knew what to do to get me. My job in the backseat of an F-4 was, again, not to fly it, although I could fly it from once we get airborne to the target, turn it back. But my job was to line the inertial navigation system, which got us to the target and got us home again, or if we had to go to a different base or something. Plus, communication, talking to the towers, talking to the front seater, talking to other squadron, how to use the radar. I mean, this was all brand new stuff to me. But I loved it. I caught on, and I passed my check ride. And subsequent to that, over the next 11 months. They didn't let me fly my last month, which is fine. I flew approximately 30 combat strikes, mm-hmm. putting in weapons in South Vietnam. Never was I supposed to go north, because that was a whole new game with missile control and stuff like that. I mean, I had no... That was what the Air Force career pilots were taught to do in at the academy and or at pilot training. So that was... My in-country training was this below the DMZ. But we did put in all kinds of weapons. From standard bombs, you see the armament display there, from 500-pound bombs, 750-pound bombs, rockets, and the awful weapon of napalm, mm-hmm. which is a devastating, awful weapon. We would come in at an angle. Part of my job was to call the airspeed and the angle, mm-hmm. so the pilot could focus on his, it's called the pipper, that's the scope, and it's a gyroscopic mm-hmm. control. And we'd come in about 450 miles an hour at about 45 degrees and ripple them, and they'd come off, and we'd had to get out of there because the fire would chase us. Mm-hmm. But it's an awful weapon. It would take one napalm tank would take a football field. It, whatever was there is gone, mm-hmm. whether it's plants or people or trees, anything. Mm-hmm. That was not fun. So I did that. I got to fly, and the squadron accepted me because of it. I became one of the fighters, although I worked in the clinics during the day, and the day that the squadron needed me to fly, the commanding officer said, all right, you're out of the clinic. Be over here at 6:40, and we're going to prep and go and have take off and land, and made it.
Mm-hmm. So your duties besides the flying then was being the doctor?
Absolutely. I was my first mission there was a physician. We had three flight surgeons for about, 70 or 80 men, pilots, and then all the crews that go with each airplane, all the maintenance people are part of my clientele. I didn't see walk-ins at the clinic. We had enough business with our own pilots, staying and keeping them healthy and so on. And then the maintenance crews also would come in to get to see the flight surgeon. However, weekends and one night a week, we had a pretty good active emergency room at the hospital, the 12th USAF Hospital, and we were assigned to take a rotation. I would say once a week at least, and we'd be there from 5 until 7 the next morning. And see everything from shrapnel to murders to drownings to colds to coughs to fights, drunks, anything. And that was my physician job. And then the next day I'd be in the clinic looking after pilots, and then the third or fourth or fifth, tenth day, I would fly. Mm-hmm. And the flying part was the thrill. It was dangerous and dumb, okay, but I loved it.
What were some of your best memories that you had when you were stationed over in Vietnam?
The memories to me would be the camaraderie that I developed with 40 guys that I had never met before and spent a year with them. We had four officers to a hooch. A hooch was a small Quonset, as we know it, North Dakota, with two beds here, and a sitting room in between, and an air conditioner. The pilots got to use it. I got to stay with the pilots. Learning to know the officers that I was assigned to and getting their confidence and becoming one of the guys, it sounds a little chauvinistic, but they accepted me because, A, I wanted to fly, and B, I was adequate. I was reasonably accomplished in it. And the memories of that, and my roommate to this day, we still communicate, as I mentioned, and my youngest son, his name is Lynn Adams, and my youngest son is Matthew Lynn. Mm-hmm. And we have a special relationship, and we flew together. We'd have a brewski now and then together. We cried together when somebody was lost, and I did lose. I lost two roommates in the 12 months, and four or five total in the squadron of that I was in, the 559th TAC Fighter Squadron. One of them It was a very special, that's not the word. One was a very sad incident where my friend and one of my roommates, his name was Captain Robert Cameron. We were flying nights, and of course my duty as nights was, the flight surgeon was to be available if there was an emergency. Well, unfortunately, this airplane took off in early 1969 in the dark, and the cabin, somehow the condensation, the fog didn't clear when they hit the power, and he couldn't see where he was going. And he, as he took off, he rotated, the airplane caught a big cement, they had side posts on the side of the runway, and he caught with his wing, and it, of course he never got off the ground, and the airplane crashed, and he was killed instantly. The backseater was killed instantly, and our squadron was on alert, so I was in the ambulance, and I was there in about 10 minutes with as a doctor. Well, there was not much to do as a doctor except say they're both dead. You could see them. One was on the runway, and one was in the cockpit yet. But all the armament weapons came off the airplane, and as it took off, it hit and went sideways and ended up like this on going down the runway, off the runway, and the weapons were bombs, bomblets, rockets, CBUs, cluster bomb units that came off like water, small cantaloupe out of a big pod, bomblets, and each one was a bomb. We're all over the territory, and as the firemen got there and we were standing at a respectable distance, all of a sudden one of the rockets that had come off caught fire and went right back into the airplane, and another massive explosion. And the fireman right next to me, I was standing, I suppose we were 50 feet away roughly, and he was on my right side, and the shrapnel came and just like a scalpel severed his whole right arm off. And he's, of course, he was bleeding and passed out, and I was standing there, and we got him out of the territory, got him out of the area, and got the bleeding stopped, and the ambulance came, and we saved him. So that, along with the combat strikes, are great moments for me to recall. One tragic, and the rest of them very special. Each one I can recount, and I've got a diary of all of them. And the people, in fact, my squadron commander was a Thunderbird boss. If you know the Thunderbirds and the Angels, which you do, just before I got there, this guy was assigned from the they shut him down for the war, basically. And they needed pilots, and they needed airplanes. So this guy came over and became my squadron commander. His name was Colonel Paul Katu. And he and I, for whatever reason, hit it off. And he liked the flight surgeons that flew, and he liked the fact that I was willing to hang it out there. And because of it, he took care of me. There's a nice greeting on the picture here from him when he left. He made full colonel. Six months later, he was bumped up to a DCO job and got out of the airplane. He didn't want to go, but he got either promoted or say, you know, you're screwed. So Colonel Cotto was a good friend, and I got to fly with him as a Thunderbird boss, and that meant you fly lead, and the other two or four with would come off of my navigation skills. Well, luckily, I seemed to learn it, and they trusted me, and we got home again, got to target, and got home again. So I flew two or three times with them, and memories of that kind of thing, incredibly, I'll go back a little. My first day in Vietnam, we landed at Seattle, McCord Air Force Base, took off, got there the next day with the time, landed, the guy that I was replacing met me, flight surgeon, and he said, before we go back on this airplane, I'm going home, you're coming over here, I'm going to introduce you to some of the squadron members. And so he took me to squadron ops, and they were sitting around, they weren't flying for the day, having coffee and talking smart, and so I get there, and I said, this is your new doc, and he had to read my name, Thorson. And he takes me, this is Bob, this is Al, this is Henry, this is Jim. And I looked at his name. I said, Jim McMullen. Yeah, I'm Jim McMullen, Major. I said, you're from Hoopole, North Dakota, and your older brother is Harvey. he was my high school coach and my peewee baseball coach. And he said, how in the hell did you know that? And that was Jim McMullen, his brother, who I'd never met, only was aware of him. And his brother then, Harvey, who lives 9 iron away from me now, my high school coach, when I went over, he said, Glenn, you may run into my brother. He just got there. I don't even know where he is. And sure as hell, excuse me, I walk into the squadron, and here's Major McMullen, Jim, and we even ended up in the same room, hooch together. This is a picture. This is Jim McMullen on our last mission. And James finished his Air Force career. This is a summary of my last mission with James, Major Mac. Mm-hmm. And he moved back to Mayville, right next door to me, where he died unexpectedly several years ago. His wife still lives right next door to me, right across the hedge. So we go from strangers to roommates to neighbors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So those kind of memories, the flying, the incidents, the awards, the thrill of combat, I guess.
What was your very first impression of Vietnam when you first landed?
Heat. It was, it's all concrete, you know, all the runways and even where the houses were. At least we had air conditioning, as I mentioned. But heat, and as an officer, I had access to at least a bed with an air conditioner. And we ate food. Of course, it was a mess hall. We officers had to pay for it, you know. Enlisted men had their own, no charge. That's great. But we used foreign MPC, monopoly money, military pay currency, it's called. So we'd have a 10-cent piece, looked like a monopoly 10-cent piece, or a 50-cent, or a dollar, or a 5, or 10, or 20, I think. And about every 6 weeks, they would change the color of them, because the VC would get a hold of these things, and they came on the base. We call them the VC National Guard. Well, they were Vietnamese who came onto the base and cleaned and did the work, that a menial work. I'm sure they were screened pretty well, but how many of them were VC? I don't know. Probably a very small amount. Anyway, if they got a hold of it, they had access to black market, so they would change it unannounced. And so if they had $500 in play money, suddenly it was zero, except because they were the wrong color. And then we had the right color. You didn't want to get caught with greenbacks. So Vietnam, my impression was the heat, the Vietnamese people were, that I experienced, were on the base and were friendly. I took care of them in the clinics. They also had access to the emergency room. So I took care of moms and dads and kids in the emergency room as a doctor. I lived a different life over there than, say, the people in the Marines and the Army, because they were in the jungles. That was awful. They were wet constantly or hot constantly, and the diseases and the wetness that goes with being in the jungle all the time. Plus, they're getting shot at all the time. So the Air Force was different in that we had a bed. They slept in the jungle. We were protected, basically, and except if you got shot down, that's a different story, but overall, it was a place that we knew what we could bomb and what we could destroy was off limits, because of McNamara, President Johnson, Dean Rusk, etc. You can't bomb anything that might kill a civilian. And you can't just go arbitrarily and say, I'm gonna this is my target, but I'm gonna go over here instead and take out this oil factory. They court-martial you. Rules of engagement. We studied them once a month. They'd have a quiz on what you could do and what you could not do. So it was a different life.
Do you feel your military service was a benefit to you?
No question about it. First of all, I grew up. I was a greenhorn North Dakota kid who had been to, you know, school and college and med school. Pretty sheltered in North Dakota and Kansas and then Fargo for a year. But I matured. I realized that the world is, some places are bad stuff going on. And war is one of them. And even though I wasn't in the jungle getting shot at, I was in the air getting shot at. and you were gone for your family. We had an R&R where my wife and I, Rose, met in Hawaii more than halfway through. I flew from Cameron to Honolulu, and she flew in a blizzard, Fargo, Billings, whatever, just to get to Seattle, and they were stuck. And then Seattle, finally, she got to Honolulu a day or two into our 7-day rendezvous, became a 5-day. I learned that there are good things going on and there are bad things going on, that you meet new friends, new acquaintances, whole new experiences. That has affected me the rest of my life in a positive way, that way. And camaraderie with pilots is something that I had not encountered before. Mm-hmm. And great memories, and diaries and pictures and friends mm-hmm. developed.
Mm-hmm. While you were over there, did you get much news back from the United States about the protests?
Yes, definitely. The Air Force Times. We got it delivered once a week, I think it was. And the protests were there. The pictures of how they disliked, especially of killing, quote, civilian Vietnamese, how the bombers were bombing civilians, and we were trying not to, but inevitably, you know, like what's going on in Israel right now in Gaza, somebody's going to get hurt. So we read about that one episode specifically. I have the Air Force Times that I saved, and it was in the spring of 69, semester break, the Zip to Zap in Zap, North Dakota. It was at the university, or all kinds of young college kids gathered, got the message, and just annihilated Zap, North Dakota, and that made front page of the Air Force Times. And I said, I've heard of Zap, I don't know where it is, but that was that, plus the fact we were told when we get home again. When I went home June 1st, 69, 1 year to the day later, we were warned, there's a phasing out of your service, and had to go to, not classes, but sessions where you signed over stuff that we got from the Air Force and what to expect when you get home. Expect very bad reception. We were even told, and maybe we're not warned so much, but if you land and go and get into your base or wherever you land at whatever airport, don't hesitate to put on civilian clothes. Don't walk through the airport, maybe, or go out to a parking lot and meet somebody with your uniform on, because it could be disastrous for you. Mm-hmm. Hollered at, condemned, spit at. And we had guys that I would go home and come back and said they were. Now, when I landed, when I came home again, I didn't. I stayed in my uniform, and I got to Seattle, McCord Air Force Base. It was early in the morning, and I was discharged, so I got an early out from there, and I flew to Minneapolis, Fargo, in my uniform, 1505s, not the flight suit, but the uniforms. And I didn't have a problem in Fargo. But stories of harassment and hate because of the war.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what did you do after you were discharged then?
I returned. I promised the group in Mayville that when I returned in 69, after 1 year, that I would set up practice in Mayville, in family practice. And one of the gentlemen retired, and it was a four-man practice, basically. It still is. But in 69, one of the older gentlemen said, Glenn, when you get back, I will retire, because he was in his 70s. And you take my spot as part of a four, and there were young physicians, and so there was four of us. Two of them had been in the Air Force themselves in peacetime. So I joined them, and I practiced medicine here from 1969 until 1996 or 7. And then, again, cold turkey retired and said, no, I can't do this. I got to work. And Valley City needed help, because they lost a couple of guys who had left. So I worked there for 2 years, and then the last year of my career, I still wanted to do something, so I went to the VA hospital and applied, and they said, yeah, we'll take you right away. You can start work next week. Mm-hmm. So I worked a year and a half at the VA in Fargo in their clinic. Then I retired totally in 2000 and what was it, 6 or 7, totally done practice medicine. Mm-hmm. So I've been retired totally for about 6 years.
So what do you do now then?
Well, I still get bored once in a while, but now I'm resigned to the fact I love to golf. We have a lovely golf club here. My wife and I, a couple of years later, bought a cottage in Detroit Lakes, where she is as we speak. Mm-hmm. And my kids then, one was at, they were all married and in jobs. So we were free to kind of come and go, and we would go to the Arizona for a month in the winters and piddle in the yard work, and then you go to the cottage to piddle in yard work back and forth. So for the past 4 or 5 years, well, that's what I've done. Now I'm good with the retirement part of it. I still have great communication with my dear friend Rich Colonel Ballstead and some of my Air Force friends. We communicate, and we don't get together except for Lynn. Lynn and I get together. But now I've accepted the fact that I'm not working anymore, and now I'm good with it.
Do you still get chances to fly at all?
Good question. The answer is yes. When I became friends of Bob Odegaard, from Fargo.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he built the Mustangs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I contacted him one day and said, I'm a past Air Force officer, flight surgeon, flew combat, da 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 da. And he picked up on that and called me and said, "All right, Glenn, let me hear your story." And I'd like to fly in a Mustang. And I got a picture of it over here. He said, "Well, the summer I'm busy going to shows and doing stuff." And he said, "So in September," this was in 2001 or 2. Over here is pictures of it. So I contacted Bob Odegaard, and he said, "Okay, I can come in September, and I'll let you know." So he called me, happened to be on my birthday in September, the 9th of September, and Bob, he said, "Yeah, I'll take you up. We got the two-seater, we got the T-model for the trainer," and he built it, of course. And he said, "I don't know what time I'll be there. It'll be in the afternoon, but you'll know when I arrive." Mm-hmm. So a couple of my friends then came out and with me, and my wife, of course, Rose. And all of a sudden from the south, from the south, here comes on the deck this P-51, nice cruising speed, and came right over the airport, Mayville, and picked it up and lifted up and did a split S and came back and landed. And that was my 62nd birthday, so that would be in 02 or 03, whatever it was. And took pictures and flew and got to fly in the Mustang.
I bet that was fun.
That was a thrill, and, you know, it's a great, one of the great American traditions in the flying in Air Force, Army, is the P-51. Mm-hmm. And I had an hour ride, we got to fly, we did some acrobatics over the city and showed off a little bit over the golf course. It was men's night, and got pictures of it, and so I got to fly. And now, of course, he was killed at the air show in Ohio, and he crashed, and then his wingman was the one that he also crashed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it was actually his son. It wasn't Bob. Bob crashed 6 or 7 years later over Valley City. At the air show, practicing for the air show.
That was just a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm. In the P-51. Mm-hmm. That was in the Corsair. That was in that old, rare, super Corsair, the red one.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I flew in this one, and I didn't get to fly in that one, but there was only one or two in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that might be the last one that's flying was, of course, he was killed instantly, and the plane was burnt completely.
Mm-hmm.
So the flying part was fun, and flying with him was a thrill, and I got to fly the airplane to boot on the P-51.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty special,
special
treat for me and memories.
And how would you like to be remembered?
First of all, as a obviously, as a family man, as my kids, they all understand that, gee, Dad, why did you expose yourself during the war like that? I said, I did it only because I wanted to. I wanted to fly, whether it was in combat or not. And I loved the flying bit. My best friend, Rich Ballstead, Colonel Ballstead, was in the Air Force. And he was there in 66 in Vietnam at Da Nang. I was still in training, interning at Fargo. He wrote me letters from Da Nang to Fargo. 2.5 years later, he's back in America, and I'm in Cameron Bay, Vietnam, writing him letters. So we grew up together. We married sweethearts, high school sweethearts. He married a classmate. My wife is a high school sweetheart. So I have a contact with him. And now we talk smart once in a while flying. And he flew F-4s. I got to fly the F-4. And that was absolutely a thrill. I drifted off the...
How would you like to be remembered?
Okay. Most of all, as a caring father, a caring physician. I practiced 38 years of medicine here in Mayville, or in North Dakota, Mayville Valley City at the VA Fargo. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that they'd be remembered as a good doc, a caring father and husband, and the fact that I did participate, maybe not welcomed by my wife, but I had a chance to do something that very few doctors do. Not only fly as a flight surgeon, which was my designation, but to fly in combat. Mm-hmm. That part to me is an incredible memory that I will go to my grave saying, this is what I did for 1 year. I took care of people over there. I had all kinds of medical experience after interning in Fargo and going to Vietnam in the Air Force. But the flying business, the flight experience was there. Now they don't allow, and rightly so, they don't allow flight surgeons, there's special training for that, mm-hmm. which I did, they don't allow them to fly in combat. Think about it, it makes sense. You've got 11, 12 years of training behind you, and you go up and get one bullet, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I was lucky enough that I didn't, but I have friends still from 40 years ago, and experiences. I got to name an airplane, even, up in that top left big picture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My wife's name is Rose, and of course she's Rosie. I'll show you that. Right here. This is a sequence of our landing on our last mission. Jim McMullen, mm-hmm. my ultimate neighbor here and friend of my brother and my coach, I've been to that. He and I were in the same squadron. Jim and I flew, we were due to be done together. And our last mission, we flew a combat strike. And I was 6 months into the program. The commander called me in and said, Glenn, how would you like to name an airplane after somebody? I said, sir, there's majors and lieutenant colonels that don't have names on their airplane. I said, that wasn't the question. Would you like to have a name put on an airplane? I said, yes, sir. So I got together with not Jim, but the other guy, and his name was his wife's name is Dolores, but her nickname was Dee. Mm-hmm. So the two of us, he said, you submit me a name and I'll approve it as long as it's not some corny name, you know. So we picked up Rosie Dee and he approved it, and next day we had an airplane name for our wives, and on the side of the cockpit, his name, it painted, our colors were blue and white, obviously, with the mm-hmm. with the squadron suits. It was his name on the front and Captain Thorson on the back. That was a very special moment. Mm-hmm. And to be selected, when there were senior men there, majors and lieutenant colonels who didn't have a name on an airplane, mm-hmm. That told me that they seemed to like me. Mm-hmm. And that I was, A, doing a job, B, I was somewhat rather competent in the back seat to trust me in an F-4 flying at 500 miles an hour.
So they didn't name the airplanes like they did in World War II. The bombers all had different names on them. And
I don't know how they selected him then. I know the Memphis Belle, for goodness sakes. I've got a picture of the Belle in here. They had to screen the name. It couldn't be a bad name. But the commander then, Colonel Cotto, who was came from the Thunderbirds. He was the boss Thunderbird guy. Again, took a liking to me, and I think that's why I got to have an airplane named. And they were some tough names on the noses of the B-17s, B-24s, yeah. B-29s. These were the guys that got the name of them were either had their wife's name or a clever, cute name, but nothing malicious or, you know, half-naked lady or whatever, and snakes or something. But because I'm a World War II nut, I read history. I take courses right as we speak at Mayville State. I go for the history courses, and one of my golfing partners is a history professor. And a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, he said, "Glenn, if you're bored, why don't you come just sit audit the classes, history?" I've been doing it. I got seven semesters in now. No credit.
Yeah.
But just the experience of learning now what I want to learn instead of gun at the head. You got to learn this by next week. And that to me was a thrill, just to have an airplane named. And the Rosie D was shot down about 6 weeks before I came home. So it's now, and I lost two roommates because of it. But that was a thrill, especially to be able to fly in it with my ultimate neighbor.
Yeah.
And friend from North Dakota.
Do you have any closing comments?
First of all, the war itself was... And how do I say this? It was run badly. And that's not my opinion. That's 100,000 officers and GIs who were sent to Vietnam to do things that didn't seem to want to end the war. The guys in the jungle that slept in the rain and the mosquitoes and the quagmires and so on that sat there, and they couldn't bomb, you couldn't shoot this target unless you were approved by officers in Washington. LBJ, President Johnson, and McNamara were calling the shots for our squadron. You can bomb this tomorrow from the White House, but you don't bomb this. If you stray off and you see something going here, you do not go to target B. You hit something maybe significant or maybe a total waste of time and or life. My experiences were something that I shan't forget. I loved the flying part of it, the camaraderie with 50 other officers in my squadron, the Billy Goat. That's the Billy Goat up there, the plaque. We were the Billy Goats of Cameron Bay, and that was our fighter was the F-4 squadron. And I enjoyed the camaraderie. I got to know people. I still communicate with my roommate. I've met people who are incredible, and I went out and picked them up in the jungle besides my squadron members, picked them up in a bag after they'd been shot down. So, great moments, sad moments, happy to come home alive.
Okay, well, thank you, Glenn.
You're welcome.